This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
How much we decide to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by and how quickly we do it is going to greatly affect what kind of summers we have 20, 30 years from now, you know, like what summers my three-year-old is going to see when he's my age. And it's something that we are very much in control on. We get to set the standard for what that's going to be in the future, and the decisions we make now will affect that.
While you're shoveling snow out of the driveway this week, you may not want to hear about extreme heat. But then again, maybe you do. This week on Sea Change Radio, we discuss the issue of a warming planet with Andrea Thompson, a science reporter and associate editor at Scientific American. We look at how people and policymakers are trying to cope with the rising temps, examine how different parts of the globe are being affected, and talk about the challenges of presenting this important information to the public in a fresh, engaging manner. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andrea Thompson. She is an associate editor at Scientific American. Andrea, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So looking at the work you've done the last few years at Scientific American, it seems like there's a lot of focus on something that we all are very concerned about, which is extreme heat. Why don't we dive into some of these stories, unpack them for our listeners, and give them a better idea of where we are and where we're headed and what we can do about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I think, you know, kind of the high-level headline was that 2023 was the hottest year on record, and by a very large margin. It was about 1.15 degrees Celsius, or about 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than the previous hottest year, 2016. And, you know, that doesn't sound like a lot, and it's not, you know, maybe day to day, but when you're talking on a global level, averaging, you know, the whole world over a whole year, that is a really huge amount. It stands out very clearly in the records. And, you know, these records, one of them is kept by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, goes back 174 years. So that's a pretty substantial time. And based on what's called paleoclimate records, so using things like tree rings or cores taken from ice sheets or sediments that can give us some glimpse of what the temperature was like before we have actual written records, there's a good chance this is, you know, the hottest the Earth has been since humans have really been around, so a couple hundred thousand years, which is really remarkable.
And here we are in the midst of winter, and there's headlines, I'm sure we can sniff them out, of record cold temperatures in Norway or Alaska or wherever, but that does not necessarily correlate to the planet not warming. So why don't you, if you can pop some of those myths for our listeners who may have gotten some disinformation about how if it's cold outside, the planet's not actually warming.
Absolutely. So the existence of climate change doesn't mean that winter doesn't happen anymore. It does sort of change the complexion of winter, depending on where you are. So, you know, winter is partly happens because of the Earth's orbit and tilt, and that's not changing with climate change. But we are seeing that winter is the fastest warming season of all the seasons. So when you look out over many, many years and over the whole season, there's a very, very clear warming signal. And the way that, you know, plays out week to week, season to winter, year to year, can be different. You know, you can still have a cold winter or cold snaps during the winter with climate change. And there are even some with in terms of snow, that's actually kind of a weird complex thing. For example, in the Great Lakes, if you're in a place that sees lake effect snow, you could potentially see more of it for a while, because warming means that those lakes don't really ice over as fast. And so when you do have cold winds coming down from Canada, you have the open water and then you get the lake effect snow. So they can actually see more lake effect snow and later into the season than they typically did in the past, which can seem a little counterintuitive.
But so that precipitation is then a function of the warming.
Yeah, exactly.
So you get a lot of snow that and there's a blizzard, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's colder outside. It's just we feel it more in our face because it's snow.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, places that got snow in the past will still get snow to some extent in the future, depending on where they are and depending on how much we warm. But we are seeing also across the Northern Hemisphere that snow cover has been going down with warming, which is about what you'd expect. You know, anytime you look on a more local level, the data always gets a lot noisier. It's much easier to look over a broad scale. But we also do see that, you know, winter's overall warmer and, you know, we are more likely to have these weird sort of warm spells like just happened across the middle of the country. Chicago and places in Iowa got right around 80 degrees in February, which is pretty wild. And we actually, I'm in Brooklyn, and yesterday was, I think we got up to somewhere in the 60, right around 60, which is pretty unusually high for us for February. You know, it's not something that was impossible in the past, but is much more likely with warming, because you have a baseline of those higher temperatures.
And you mentioned how the Earth's tilt, its axis, affects the difference in temperatures between the Northern and Southern Hemisphere. Obviously, it's the summer, late summer in Southern Hemisphere. Have we seen some anomalous weather patterns that are troubling in, let's say, Australia?
Yeah, so they've definitely had some heat in Australia. They've had drought, they've had wildfires. They've actually had that in parts of South America too. Wildfires have actually been particularly notable in a couple places. Colombia has seen, I think it was about 500 fires in January or more than, which is far more than they would typically see in that month. And part of that is linked to warmer weather and drier weather. And there have been some what are called attribution studies, so where they kind of specifically look for the fingerprints of climate change in particular events, and have found that climate change is maybe playing a role in the drought that's sort of in the Amazon basin and sort of the wider area around that. And there have also been some wildfires down in Chile that were actually deadly. And there's big concerns over wildfires in the Amazon because it's one of the worst droughts ever recorded there. And it's possible that El Nino, which is happening right now, is also playing some role there. Its effects are especially strong in South America because it is a phenomenon that happens in the eastern tropical Pacific. So that's right off the west coast of South America. But, you know, it's clear that climate change is the bulk of what's causing what we're seeing globally and there.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Andrea Thompson. She's an associate editor at Scientific American. So, Andrea, we were talking about the southern hemisphere. Let's turn to the northern one that has the most land mass, that has the most people. And as a result, we get a lot more news during our summer about extreme heat. This last summer, you wrote about how half the world's population faced extreme heat for at least 30 days in 2023 in the summer. This is not going to change. How are people starting to adapt, and how are policymakers trying to help their populaces survive and thrive in the midst of this new reality?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and one that varies a lot from place to place. There is a growing movement. I don't know if you would call it a movement, but more places are hiring what are called sort of heat health officers, or maybe you call them heat czars.
The opposite of the heat miser. Sorry.
Yes.
Could not help myself.
Someone who is sort of coordinating and thinking about that very question. And I'm trying to remember exactly some places in the U.S. I think Miami has one, and maybe Phoenix. Some countries in Europe have employed this strategy too. And then putting in place public policies, like in New York, we have cooling centers. So on days where the heat is going to be in exceptionally high for us, and you know what is exceptional for us is not going to be the same as for Phoenix, you know, people are there are adapted to a higher level of heat than in New York, and are more likely to have air conditioning. But there are, you know, libraries or other places that are open to the public on particularly hot days so that people can cool down. And so kind of expanding things like that, looking at equitable access to air conditioning is another one. People who are poorer are less likely to be able to afford air conditioning, and that can also particularly become important at night. We tend to talk most about, you know, the, oh, here's the high that was, you know, a high of 120 or whatever that was hit today in Phoenix. And those are important, but possibly more important are the overnight lows. And if those are particularly high, it's a lot harder for human bodies to have the kind of recovery time they need. So if you have overnight lows that only get in, you know, to around 80, that's exceptionally hot for night. And it makes it so much harder to recover. And I think that's something that's really underappreciated, because there's always so much emphasis on, you know, on the daytime highs.
Right. We always hear about these record highs, and we're almost like greedy for these numbers. Like, it hit 136 in Abu Dhabi, but like, try sleeping in Abu Dhabi that night when it was 110. That's not so simple either, especially if your air conditioning is either on the fritz or non-existent.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's something that, you know, people are trying to get the message about more, and, you know, what can people do? Like, if you don't have air conditioning, what are some strategies? And a lot of that is staying hydrated, finding shade, you know, looking for places like cooling centers, being aware of what some of the symptoms of heat illness and heat stress are. And that's particularly important when you're talking about people who spend a lot of time outdoors, especially construction workers or people who work in agriculture, where you're really in the sun a lot and you're doing very intensive work. And there is, you know, a growing movement among in some of the worker spaces, so unions or other organizations of labor, to put more worker protections in place, because there currently aren't really rigorous OSHA standards. So they have been working on getting more rigorous standards in place at the federal level for a long time, and it just isn't coming out. A few cities, I can't remember which, but a couple in Texas and Miami have been looking at setting their own standards. Oh, I think it's Miami-Dade County, not Miami, the city. To set their own ordinances for, you know, every so many hours, workers should get a 10-minute water and shade break or something like that. And state governments, particularly in those two states, Florida and Texas, have pushed back on that. They're both Republican-led states, both the legislature and the governors. and for business reasons have said, no, we don't want that because you'll have a patchwork of requirements that's going to be confusing for businesses to follow. But it seems a bit perverse to tell people you can't set safety requirements for people who have to deal with extreme heat. So that's kind of playing out right now.
What are some of the arguments that are put forth by these Republican legislatures that are prohibiting policy to try to give people relief from this extreme heat, essentially?
Yeah, so the main one is that, well, if Miami-Dade has this ordinance and another county in Florida has another ordinance and then Duval, which is where Jacksonville is, has another one, you know, that's going to be really confusing for businesses who have to, you know, have different standards for different places, is one of theirs. Most of it's on economic. They say, like in Florida, they say it's going to cost the state economy too much and that it's more important. It is more beneficial to workers to have a strong economy and lots of jobs than these protections.
So it's more like, let's get the government red tape out of our lives.
Yeah, a bit is sort of their message. You know, healthcare advocates will point to that there have been deaths among workers in these sectors, and that the, you know, current basically voluntary protections are insufficient, that there need to be more rigorous standards in place to make sure people get the relief they need, and this is only going to become more and more of a problem.
And as a science reporter, how do you continue to find fresh angles to report this annual rite of passage? You have an obligation to your readers to continue to make them aware of this, and I feel that way at Sea Change Radio as well. But maybe you can kind of give us a little insight into your process and how you try to report this issue with a fresh perspective so people don't tune it out.
Yeah, that is one of the key challenges of covering this area. And I think it's something that every climate reporter contends with. So some of it is, you know, in the case of 2023 setting the record, and sort of within that, we had July was the hottest year or the hottest month ever recorded. September set a monthly record by the most that's ever been recorded. So sometimes I use those records to sort of help explain aspects of the climate system or put into perspective. We also at Scientific American have a really great graphics team that is helpful in terms of conveying sometimes the information in that graphical form, which can really help sort of present it in a way that I think can be more immediately impactful because you can just look at the picture and get it. I do a lot of talking to climate scientists, watching what they say, you know, and talk about on social media, looking at studies, and just sort of saying like, oh, they made a point that I haven't really thought about or that was, you know, I think really helpful. And probably the best example of that was summer before last, when Gina Raimondo, the Secretary of Commerce, made a comment in regards to some of the heat from that summer, which was also pretty notable, that, you know, this summer is very hot, but it's effectively going to be the coolest of the rest of our lives. And that really struck me as such a good way to sort of take a thing that was happening now and put it in the longer term context, because everyone that summer was talking about, oh my God, it's been so hot. This is awful. It's awful.
Kind of a glass half full perspective, right? It sounds pretty terrible, but on the other hand, it's like, hey, July was the hottest month in record. But on the flip side, you just enjoyed the coolest July for the rest of your lives.
And it's, you know, it's important. It's not every summer is going to be hotter than the last because you still have year-to-year variability. And that's one thing that I think often confuses, makes it confusing to talk about climate change. But, you know, a summer like this last year or the summer before that, 20 or 30 years from now, is going to be an average summer. It's not going to be something that's going to be exceptional like it is now. And sort of helping people understand that what we're living right now is very much, even when it's extreme and in kind of an outlier, is a glimpse of what we're going to see more in the future. But also making the point that to what degree that is the case is very much within our control. how much we decide to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by and how quickly we do it is going to greatly affect what kind of summers we have 20, 30 years from now. You know, like what summers my 3-year-old is going to see when he's my age. And it's something that we are very much in control on. We get to set the standard for what that's going to be in the future. And the decisions we make now will affect that. And that's, you know, if it's something that people are concerned about, that's something that they need to tell government officials that that's something I want action on, that I want us to do now and make those cuts. And, you know, it's not an easy thing, but the technology exists. Renewable energy is pretty mature. It is cost competitive with fossil fuels. It's just a matter of getting it up and running and getting a lot of that will take some, you know, government policy to sort of get it on that first footing. But it's crucial. It's the only thing that's really going to get us there is totally changing how we power our society.
Hot pants! Hey, hot pants! Hot pants! Smoking that hot pants! That's where it's at! That's where it's at! Take your pants up on! It looks much better time! My feet will keep going! Girl! Blowing my mind! Thinking of losing that funky feeling, don't cause you got to use what you got to get just what you want.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Andrea Thompson. She's an associate editor at Scientific American. So, Andrea, we're talking about how you cover extreme heat issues. Also, you're a storyteller. Maybe give us a glimpse into some of the stories that have touched you, people who've been affected by the changing climate.
Yeah, so one of the really affecting stories I wrote was on an attribution study looking at drought in the Horn of Africa. So that's Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya, that area. And it was specifically focused on drought, but heat is a major component of drought. So, you know, precipitation is one side, heat is another. You set the stage for drought often by having less rain than normal. But when you have high heat acting with that, it tends to dry out soils and crops and things more than would be the case. And this looked at a particular drought that's been happening over a couple years in that Horn of Africa region. And it was a combination of five seasons of failed rains in a particular season, you know, combined with heat. And they found that, you know, that climate change played a really clear role in this. And that was hugely impactful to the people in that area who often, you know, are subsistence farmers or keep livestock. People were forced to migrate to other regions in search of water or, you know, for pasture for their livestock or just to find food. And I think that is, you know, helpful to keep in mind. It's for many of us in the U.S., obviously not for everyone, heat is perhaps more of a nuisance than anything. But in some areas and for some populations, you know, it's a matter of survival and sort of making that clear and realizing the effect that it has on so many people across the world, you know, millions. And that's just one example. And it has, you know, the groups that are sort of already most vulnerable to a lot of things, young children, older people, people who are poor, who, you know, may not have money for things like air conditioning, people who have pre-existing health conditions like maybe heart disease or lung ailments like asthma, are more vulnerable to extreme heat than, you know, an average sort of healthy adult. And that makes it really hard, you know, when you have these already vulnerable groups being hit even more by these climate changes. And heat isn't the only climate change that can affect a lot of these populations more. But, you know, recognizing that, you know, that for a lot of us where it's just, oh, this is uncomfortable, heat is really dangerous and deadly for a lot of people.
And human nature tends to be able to compartmentalize and to read a story about somebody in Kenya or Yemen being affected by extreme heat and be sympathetic, but not truly empathetic, not being able to really relate to it, which is why I thought the wildfire smoke stories that we've been seeing over the last 5 to 10 years can really resonate with urban populations on a mass scale. I mean, in San Francisco, the sun was obscured from smoke from wildfires. And I know last summer, New York got hit with Canadian wildfire smoke. And so it becomes real for people. And it's not just a nuisance. It's we all are in this together. They're unfortunate episodes, but I think there's a silver lining behind them in that it can wake people up.
Yeah, and I think that happens with a lot of climate-related extremes and disasters. You know, when Katrina happened, I remember at the time, and I wasn't yet a reporter, I had just finished my degree studying meteorology and atmospheric chemistry. But it caused a lot of people to ask, like, oh, is this climate change? Is this climate change? And, like, we couldn't really answer that question in a robust scientific way at the time. But we can say a lot more with a lot of events, extreme events that happen now, particularly with heat. And pretty much every heat extreme that's been studied in that way, it is very clear that climate change is playing a role in making it worse, making it happen more often, and making heat last longer. And a couple of the extremes last year, the one that, so the heat, kind of endless heat in the southwest of the U.S., and then in parts of Europe, they found, a study found that basically they would not have happened without climate change. You know, if you took those same weather patterns and stripped out the climate change signal, you wouldn't have seen those extremes. That's, you know, it's about as clear cut as you can get. You know, it's a little trickier with other ones, with precipitation. There are a lot more things you have to look at, more variables. But we do often see very, you know, obvious signals that climate change is making extreme rainfall worse, making flooding more likely. You know, there are clear signals in drought and many other things. So we can really tell people and pretty quickly that this extreme you're experiencing is due in large part to climate change. And I do think it does help people sort of make it less abstract and make it less of a thing that, oh, that's just happening in the future, to no, it's happening now. And I think that's really important to get across.
She's an associate editor at Scientific American, Andrea Thompson. Andrea, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The New Master Sounds, Mr. Sadhead, and James Brown. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.